So similar to what you have within refrigeration systems, there is a change of phase going from a liquid to a gas. Liquid cooling is something that exists. You have air cooling, liquid cooling, immersion cooling within the data centers. And normally you have a single phase cooling. So then there's water, for example, which stays in one phase. It always stays liquid. And then the water heats up with sensible heat, let's say, and then you dump the heat again. In our case, we're actually changing from liquid to a gas and absorbing heat that way, which is a much more efficient way to absorb heat. And then we can also dump the heat very efficiently by going back from a gas to a liquid. And then the loop continues. So that is where we use simulations as much as we can. Two-phase simulations are notoriously difficult. So going through the simulation side allows us to really quickly iterate, do some really stupid stuff, which I wouldn't be able to afford or try. And then usually it doesn't work, but then once in a million it does. And then you have something new.
Hi, my name is Gareth Thomas from Tangible Computing. This is a podcast about where computing meets the real world, from the fast and the complex, like controlling an engine, to the imaging of a patient or even scheduling an airline. We want to trigger your curiosity by talking to the people behind the scenes of making the modern world happen, deepening your understanding of where computation plays a role in our everyday lives and motivating you to help engineer a better world.
I'm Andrew Rutgers, co-host of Tangible Computing.
This podcast is powered by Version Bay, a consulting company that offers experienced consultants to professionalize your MATLAB, Simulink, and Python projects, minimizing the risk and quantifying the value in migrating to newer software environments.
And now, let's find out how software drives the world.
Today on Tangible Computing, we have Rudy Berweg on the call today, and he is the CEO of a company called InCooling. We've heard a lot about you. I know you've been on a couple of podcasts, and I would like to maybe kickstart today's podcast off with a fun fact about yourself, that maybe something that not many people know about you.
You see my signature, it's always very, very badly written. And I think it's always funny when we have major documents and major deals. And then there's a 12-year-old signature in the bottom, which I'm proud. So it doesn't matter.
When you say you have major deals, this is because you run a company called InCooling. Can you tell us a little bit more about what is InCooling and what do you guys actually do?
Of course. So at InCooling, we started around 3 years ago building cooling systems using two-phase technology. And so we built cooling systems for the data center. Data centers are a major energy user. We all enjoy data centers' capabilities to make our lives better. I mean, we're doing this interview through the internet, and we're distributing it through the data centers as well. But it costs a lot of energy, and a lot of these energy-consuming devices also produce heat. We are specifically focusing on the servers, on the chips, building two-phase cooling systems for that. And we've been doing that now for a couple of years, really focusing on trying to make it more energy efficient, but also increasing performance of the servers. And there we get into the tangible computing side. Like, we provide computing in that sense, or increase their computing performance. And then we want to see that being used for good, of course.
So just to dive a little bit deeper, when you say two-phase cooling, can you like elaborate a little bit more about what that actually is?
For sure. So similar to what you have within refrigeration systems, there is a change of phase going from a liquid to a gas. So there is liquid cooling is something that exists. You have air cooling, liquid cooling, immersion cooling within the data centers. And normally you have a single phase cooling. So then there's water, for example, which stays in one phase. It always stays liquid. And then the water heats up with sensible heat, let's say, and then you dump the heat again. In our case, we're actually changing from liquid to a gas and absorbing heat that way, which is a much more efficient way to absorb heat. And then we can also dump the heat very efficiently by going back from a gas to a liquid. And then the loop continues. So it's relatively simple, similar to what you have in a fridge or HVAC systems. Two-phase systems are being built for 200 years already. But what we're doing is really integrating them in the servers, making them highly efficient and easy to implement within the data center.
So when you say you implement this in a server, so is this a physical device that you attach on side chips, or is it something that you manufacture your own servers that you sell? How should I understand this?
So the cooling systems, they have to be integrated in the server. So we do two things. We do, on one side, we work with server manufacturers and we sell our cooling system, and then they implement it in their products. And we also have, let's say, direct collaborations where we also are involved in the design of the servers. And those systems are then going to the clients with a bit more customization going on the server side.
So when you say that you've got you're cooling these servers, can you maybe just give me an idea of how hot do servers actually get? And can you accurately control the temperature with this two phase, or is it less accurate? How should I understand this?
Yeah, so on the server side, we are focusing on mainly CPUs. You have CPUs, GPUs, and then there's also accelerator cards, and those are usually the biggest heat sources. And on the CPU side, you can imagine a CPU going at 85 degrees, 90 degrees when it's really stressed out, especially now that we're getting higher and higher core count CPUs. It's really getting quite extreme, and there the heat has to be dissipated. And if you don't have a cooler, yeah, it wouldn't really run at the speeds that you would like to. What we have seen is that even with quote-unquote state-of-the-art air cooling, the CPUs are still not running at maximum frequencies that they're built to get to. And that is just a giant waste. It's very interesting to see the billions and billions and billions of dollars pumped into CPU designs and manufacturing. We have a very close relationship with ASML. They have amazing technologies to build these CPUs. And then all the way down the line, the last step, a $40 piece of metal is put on the 10,000 euro chip. Yeah, that's really, really silly. And those kind of things, they open a possibility for a startup to do something special. When it comes to startups on our side, in my opinion, it can only work if other companies neglected something for a long time and are just either not seeing something or they're not able to capitalize on it for whatever reason. And that is, in this case, in my opinion, also going on. And that's where we stepped in that hole to say, okay, we see two-phase cooling, 200 years old technology. We see it being implemented in research institutes such as CERN, where we got a whole bunch of inspiration from, but also bigger companies as Philips, ASML, they're also implementing two-phase. Why is this not being adopted in the data center? And then we took that technology and implemented in inside servers in this case. And the second question was about the technology, to say, capabilities. The nice thing of two-phase is that as long as you control the pressure, you will control the boiling point. The boiling point is the change of phase, right? So going from liquid to gas. And this boiling happens at a certain temperature, depending on the pressure. Just like when you boil a pot of water, if you do it here at sea level, or you do it on a mountain, the temperature where it boils is different. And that pressure control is where a really big difference is made when it comes to two-phase. Because if you are overshooting, let's say it's too late, then there's too much vapor, there's too much gas, and then there's no more cooling capacity because all the liquid is gone. Or the other side, you don't boil all the liquid off, and that can also damage the system because it's meant to receive vapor after the heat source. And that is an interesting balancing game, which one of the major reasons why this type of phase change cooling was not implemented before. And now the technologies have evolved quite a lot. This is not something that we have developed on our own. This is also the industry as a whole rising to the challenge, let's say, and building these systems for other applications. Military applications is a really big driver of technology. Whatever your opinions are of the defense industry, there is definitely a big drive towards new stuff. And that is now rolling out into other high-end applications, in this case, server cooling. And then eventually it will go to automotive, it will go to computer, it will go to your mobile phone in theory, right? Okay, that's how it kind of like trickles down. And if you buy a laptop now, there's always some sort of two-phase cooling in there. In this case, heat pipes, if you have a high-end laptop. So there's already two-phase in our daily lives. And even in phones, I've seen heat pipes now in there with a little bit of water in there, and it evaporates and it moves the heat around the phone. So we are just tapping into that larger trend, but we have stepped it up a bit, and we are not shy of the complexity of technology. And that's why we went for something more complicated, but it comes with really interesting opportunities.
So it sounds like this is a very interesting application, but when you put it on the CPUs, I'm assuming that this enables the CPUs to run faster. So this is a bit of like the overclocking. And you also mentioned
it was a little bit more efficient. Can you maybe speak a little bit about, so how much faster do you think you can, or on average can you get? And is it at the cost of huge electricity bills, or is this effectively just a cheaper way of cooling than putting fans left, right, center in the servers?
Yeah, so the easy answer is it depends. So it depends on the CPU, depends on the application, depends on the environment that you're in. If you look at the speed of the CPU, if you are not limited by voltage, for example, or by other things, but the temperature is really the limiting factor, then you can significantly increase speed. It goes up to 75%, really, really a significant amount, depending on the CPU. Obviously, then you go out of spec, usually. So if you go that far, if you want to go overclock 20, 30, 40, up to 70%, yeah, everybody gets a little nervous. So it has to be for the right application. But for some applications, this is still useful. This can be mission critical stuff that has to wait real time. Maybe you're analyzing data that has to be in real time be analyzed. And then you need the speed. Then companies opt in for these kind of solutions. Usually those solutions are water cooled. And we are providing an alternative to the water cooling with our two-phase cooling, with even lower temperatures on the cold plate. And then on the question about the efficiency, it's all about performance or efficiency in that sense. They go hand in hand. So the more efficiency you get, the more performance you can get out of it per watt. And there we are extremely good. So at the top end, we are very efficient. But right now we're building Ferraris, and you don't go grocery shopping with them because it's very difficult to do that economically. So these are extremely fast servers, some of the fastest servers in the world, and they're very efficient. But then comparing to a super efficient server to run email hosting, yeah, we're not in the same league. So the energy consumption is still significant, still a serious server, and there's no free lunch in that sense. Having said that, we are about 30% more efficient than high-end water cooling when it comes to the same size of chips. It depends again for the chip and the environment. If we're in Abu Dhabi in a very hot environment, it's maybe different, or humidity is different, but on average that's just something that you can expect when it comes to efficiency gains per watt. Having said that, we're pushing more watts to the CPU. So in the end, we might come into exactly the same energy consumption, but we have done more work. And that is, I think, the critical part. This is very difficult to express in percentages or in numbers, because we may be able to do what two servers do with one. Then there is a huge energy gain. There's also materials, of course, that you're consuming. When you look at the full sustainability picture, let's say, we don't need two servers. And that is an interesting debate that we're having, to see what is the actual impact without trying to overblow it, because it's so easy to point fingers and say, look, these others are so bad and there's so much power consumption and blah, blah. But you need to have a really good argument that is actually backed up with data. And that's where we are now. We're doing actual tests within the data centers, measuring everything from temperatures coming in and out. Because what is the impact on a data center level? Data centers are now cooled with giant air conditioning units. That cold air goes to the racks and they come out as warm air, and then that has to be cooled again. We have now introduced a second cooling loop, an actual cooling loop, not just a way to move heat, but actually to cool the CPUs down. That means that we can have, for example, higher temperature than supplied by the central air conditioning. And that has huge impacts on the temperature, also on the efficiency. And that is hard to calculate right now. So we really need to get the proofs in the pudding and get some real data. What would this mean? And then extrapolate that on a 1 megawatt size instead of just 1 kilowatt on one server. And then you can really get the impact that we're looking for. On the short term, it's about local efficiency. But on the long term, it's about global efficiency. And there, I think it's really exciting what this technology can bring to only cool the CPUs that actually need cooling, to go away from compressor cooling as much as possible on the roofs, because then you're cooling the whole data center. And of course, there are smart technologies out there distributing air in the data center, trying to already optimize per rack level. But we're going per chip level, and we can do it with extreme speed by chasing the pressure. We can very quickly react to the CPUs changing, a different load comes in, we're immediately up to speed. While a whole room, it just takes time, and you can't be looking at the one CPU in one rack. If you have hundreds of racks, you can't be changing the air conditioning for that. And that is where we're going for. Obviously, this only works for the high end. This doesn't work for the standard servers, and that's where we're focusing on. So when you look at applications like simulations that are core bound, that you can't scale, or you're looking at software where you can't be able to just add more because it's in serial. You can't do a parallel compute. You're waiting on one to be done. The worst ones are you start with one machine that has to calculate, and then that one machine distributes to other machines. So then that means that one machine can be holding up 1,000 servers. That is possible. And that is just an extremely expensive problem. And there we have a solution that is very, very interesting for customers to try and see, can we eliminate as many bottlenecks as possible? And that is also why we got into the servers business ourselves, right? Why we wanted to customize our own servers, because we see you solve one bottleneck, CPU speed, and then five more pop up. And then we are able to actually solve those things down the line, the infrastructure, the networking, the power supply, everything starts to shift to somewhere where it hasn't been before, because always the CPU was a bottleneck. And that is for us, yeah, a really interesting challenge to also pick up, okay, how can we make the whole solution and not just move the problems to the other departments and say, yeah, good luck, guys. We'll see you in 2 years when you make something new.
Can you describe what this looks like? I mean, is this additional hoses on it on the server? What am I seeing?
Yeah. So when it comes to the server and how does this impact the server itself? The system is completely housed within the server. So what we intentionally have gone for was a completely integrated system, meaning no external pipes, no new floors, no new infrastructure, no new knowledge. Everything stays the same. You buy a new server. The server happens to have cooling technology in there, and it just receives your standard air. It comes in as cold air. It comes out as hot air. That's where we're starting now. The reason is there has been a lot of good technologies out there for decades. Water cooling is a really good one. Immersion cooling, I'm a big, big fan of, where you take the whole server and you immerse it in a bath of oil or a Novac or another refrigerant or dielectric, and that cools this service extremely efficiently. There are some good companies out there also in the Netherlands. I think Aspiritas is a really good one, where the team is really excited. It's a lot of knowledge in there, a lot of experience, and the product that they have built works really well. But it's not for all data centers this makes sense. You can't implement immersion cooling everywhere because it requires new infrastructure and new knowledge. For us, everything sits in, and it's a really good stepping stone for the industry to also get to the new technologies without having to change much. I may not even notice, they may have just bought a cooling server and Trojan horse was in there, and there was a super efficient cooling system. Of course, the energy bill will be happy, and the guys working on the software that runs on the servers will be super happy, because all of a sudden everything goes faster. But it shouldn't be a huge bottleneck or headache to get this going. Having said that, it's a shoebox-sized system, fits inside the server, where all our technology is housed. And we just use fans to pull the air through. And for the rest, it's a simple solution in that sense. We have more ambitious plans for larger scale systems, but those are going to be faced with some of the same challenges the other players are having. And history tells us that it's kind of difficult to implement those things. Water is, of course, also something a lot of data centers are scared of. Putting water next to your precious hardware is a pretty scary. In our case, if for whatever reason a nuclear explosion happens and our server cooling things are broken, I don't know how to do, or somebody in the data center has a hammer, starts hammering, then our server will have a gas leak, a dielectric gas leak, and not water spilling all over the servers. And that is also a peace of mind that we can give, on top of the fact that we're doing the lower temperatures and more performance.
So this sounds very interesting, Rudy. So maybe just to kind of dig a little bit deeper into you as a person and how you came to this very niche area. How did you start with this? Did you one day, were you playing a computer game and saying, I wish my CPU could run 10 times faster? How did you get to here? Tell us the story.
Yeah. If you allow me to entertain you for a couple minutes, where did this go wrong? Right? How did I end up here? Really, really early on, I always had a good experience with computers through my dad. So my dad, as a young adult, he built computers when they really, really were soldering kits, right? So the really early stuff. So there was always a good feeling about computers, and he always kept that knowledge up. We used to have these magazines of computer stuff come on the doormat every week. And from that time, I picked one up and thought, oh, this is pretty cool. But I never really went for it. And then one day, there was this game that I really wanted to play, and it required a computer. So I was like, oh, no, I guess I have to try and find something that I can afford. And then I got into it a bit. I bought my first laptop. And then from that point on, it started to, the game stuff, animations, games, started to really get pull me in. I wasn't doing that good in school. I have dyslexia. So I was not dumb, but I wasn't really able to describe what I learned in the test and around when it really counts to write something down. I wasn't really able to do that. So that made it a little bit difficult, but also allowed me to set my sights on a bit more of the lone wolf path. Like, okay, let me just learn what I think is important to learn. Yeah, it took a lot of time to get into computers and animations and game art. And then I realized I can actually do this as a study here in Eindhoven. So I used to live in Nijmegen. I moved to Eindhoven for study at St. Lucas, which was game art and animations. And that blew my mind. You could build whole worlds with a mouse, keyboard, and a computer. And that is just crazy. Anything I wanted, it was basically possible. That was very liberating. The industry itself is a very tough one. Game art and animation. Sometimes I see it a bit as a horse riding. There's too many people that love horses. And then the people that most people in that industry don't make a good income because there's too many people that love it. And there's a whole bunch of people that love gaming, but they're not set for game art or the game designers. There's not the same. But nevertheless, I went for the study because I think it felt right. And then I realized, okay, computing is a really important part. In animations especially, it turns out the simulations to do an animation with water in there is exactly the same as we're doing in the actual industry. We're using the exact same models to solve this. And that blew my mind once again that this actually is something I can apply to the real world. So yes, I could build anything inside this game engine. But because games have to be realistic, it turns out you have to use real physics. Then I realized, well, if I use real physics, why don't I actually build in real life? And so I set out to go and build hardware. And 3D printing was a really important part there. I worked at the 3D print store for a bit. Then I realized my files can just be put in this thing and it comes out as a real thing. Obviously, all kinds of silly plastic stuff is not the same as the high-tech stuff we're working on now. But back then, another critical moment in my life to see this can be translated to real life easily. And then, yeah, I just knew I wanted to go into hardware. Me and my friends, we started some things. One of my best friends, we started a company where we build drones, racing drones. So you have a small frame and you use these goggles to see what the drone sees. They go around 180 kilometers an hour. And we started to make this business out of it. Okay, you can buy these frames for the geeks out there that love to build things. And you can program your own stuff. And we just provide the frame. And we 3D printed the aerodynamic shells. I was introduced to CFD on the aero side. All those stuff, they were compounding. And then I always had a good sense for business. So I love business. I love building things. I love creating things out of nothing. That originally got me into the games. And now it got me into business. And yeah, I knew I wanted to do something. But it's not so easy to start a hardware company. It's very, very expensive. And all the ventures that I have done in the past, they were great. We learned a lot. But most of the money was made with the things around it. So the services that we could give for it. For example, building camera equipment. We weren't making the money with the camera equipment. We were making the money with using it because the skill level was high. And then I realized, okay, this is maybe not the way to go. So I had a couple months where I was just freelancing, making a buck, putting some down for savings for when the time comes to actually do something big. And then I got introduced to Hightech Excel here in Eindhoven. Hightech Excel being a venture building program where they connect research institutes, big companies here in the region, and entrepreneurs to try and build new stuff. A really unique setup. We were part of the first batch, the first cohort. It was a very, very experimental thing. And I remember it was summertime. I had my own business. I had my own office. I had all my stuff there. But the summertime in Netherlands, everything stops. So everything was super quiet. So I was like, let me just go by, have a beer and see what this Hightech Excel thing is about. Then I saw this super cool opportunity. I said, this sounds like a great hobby. I don't have a life anyway. I would love to put more time into business. And this sounds like something I can do consistently. As people know that they're freelancers, the freelance life is not consistent. And from time to time, there's just sea of space. All of a sudden it's like, oh, I have 4 days of nothing and I can't get another sale really quickly, so let me just do this for a bit. Well, that turned into a super big obsession with oh, wow, we have this cooling technology here that I'm allowed to use to build a business around. And these all these experienced people around me that are actually going to help me. And all because they just think it's a cool project. Well, this is an opportunity I can't let go of. And then together with two other co-founders, we started Think Cooling, where we wanted to try and use this technology, this cooling technology in the data center industry to try and solve some of the biggest problems that I have personally seen with my own eyes when the servers went really hot, 105 degrees, and all of a sudden things slow down. So you have a render time and it says, oh, it's going to be 16 hours and then it's going to be 17. And every hour it actually adds an hour. And it goes the other way around because it starts heating up and the whole cluster is starting to slow down. And that is something that is imprinted in my memory that, okay, this is a problem because we have a deadline tomorrow and I can't finish this. And if we have this, this must be everywhere. And now within cooling, we're going everywhere from five-man companies all the way to 5,000. And they all have the same problems. Let's try and solve those. So that is a bit of the journey to get here, all kinds of experiences, all kinds of feelings, also passions and excitements, mistakes, big mistakes, costly mistakes. But I've done them when costly means 100 euros or 200 euros when you're a student. And costly mistakes means, oh, we ordered this thing from a manufacturer and then we forgot to put in the bolts on the right side. And now the whole batch is gone for 250 euros. Well, that broke my heart. It broke my heart. But now it wouldn't have mattered because those kind of mistakes are now 100,000 euros or half a million euros mistakes, right? And those I don't want to make, try to avoid to make because they're too expensive. And that is interesting to start early. And while you're still studying, if you have the chance, yeah, start building stuff because hardware is so expensive that you can't afford to have mistakes when everybody is looking at you. And this is when it has to happen. And people are literally depending on you. So, yeah.
So maybe to dive a little bit deeper on that. So you kind of called out with this concept of avoiding making expensive mistakes as something that you learn. Do you kind of see the value of simulation and also to in your cooling company, do you use simulation also as a means to avoid that half a million bolting mistake that you want to do? Can you maybe share a few words on that?
Absolutely. I think it's very multidimensional in the sense that simulations as a concept, simulations and calculating as well by hand is also something I would consider in that same ballpark, is try and limit randomness in the process. That is, of course, useful. And the randomness, also my intuition, is a form of noise sometimes. As I've been building hardware, I've always listened to my intuition. The brain is a very, very powerful computer. Talking about tangible computing, there's nothing more tangible than this because even The idea of tangible computing is being computed in our heads. It's insane. And there is a large part of your brain that you're not accessing directly, but it's just working. And it comes in very subtle clues. You're drinking a cup of tea and you just get it and it works. So you have to trust in that. But if you can expand your brain a bit and add another lobe, which is called, for example, ANSYS, and you add that to your brain, wow, that is very powerful. And in tandem with your intuition, you can make some really, really fast iterations of designs, of ideas, of concepts. And the discipline of putting it inside a software package also forces you to think about the whole problem and not just the surface. Because that is the problem with this computer in your head is that it is very, very broad stroked. Somehow you can imagine an elephant, but I don't see all the details. It's just a broad stroke of an elephant and the feeling that an elephant gives, whatever that means. And that is not very useful if you think about a phase changed microchannel interaction. Then you can't broad stroke it because then something will be missed. And what is really interesting with a closed loop cooling system is that every point in the loop affects all the other points. So if something changes on the CPU side, let's say there's all of a sudden somebody turns on a game and then the CPU ramps up, then that action will affect every point in the loop. And it goes in cycle, it goes in ripples, and it becomes very, very complicated very quickly. When you're familiar with software development, you can do like a flow chart or type of thing. Like if this happens, then this happens. But it soon becomes so insane that you can't follow it anymore. And then intuition stops to work. It gets the file becomes so big it can't be loaded in your temporary memory. So that is where we use simulations as much as we can. Two-phase simulations are notoriously difficult. So you have to have test setups to really feed the data, otherwise it's not going to work. And because we're doing stuff that it hasn't been done that much, there's also not that much literature we can build upon, especially not for the parts that we are building ourselves, where we think we can have real value. There we have to create that value ourselves. So going through the simulation side allows us to really quickly iterate, do some really stupid stuff, which I wouldn't be able to afford or try. And then usually it doesn't work, but then once in a million it does. And then you have something new, right? And what I always find interesting is if you look at discoveries, especially in the chemical discoveries, it's always some accidental stuff. Like it's always like, I was building this thing, we're making this weight loss pill, and then I dropped this bucket in here, and then all of a sudden we have like styrofoam. And like, yes, here we have something new. Obviously, that is not something that's as easy with hardware because it takes a while. And a hardware mistake usually means machining went wrong, and then you can't do much with it. While with a software package or simulation sites or anything that can be done in that secondary brain, it allows for some very powerful stuff. And that is also, of course, what we're using our own technology for. So we're realizing, okay, our own simulations, we need more compute. We need faster compute because people are literally waiting. And I found it interesting that in a company that's as small as Inkooning, we already have moments where multiple engineers are staring at their screens, waiting and waiting and waiting some more. And we have some pretty good computers here. That's literally our business. So it is interesting to see that problem. And I think that's the dark side of this simulation side, can be the dark side of the simulation side, because it is a expensive proposition to have your people wait on the compute. And there we're trying to really add value, because tens of thousands of engineers in the Netherlands, even just the small country, the Netherlands, are probably staring at their screens right now, waiting until some simulation is done. That is crazy. And especially if then there's another team waiting on that team, then that it just escalates. It is a weird realization to think about how dependent we are on this computing side, and how even if it only takes 20 minutes, it breaks your flow, it breaks your day up. That is something that is very dangerous. And it induces a state of nothingness for a bit, which you do every day, every month, every year, times a whole company. It's just very, very expensive. So all those things that I didn't realize were happening also in the professional, quote unquote, industries, like engineering and the hardcore stuff, like we're building tanks or we're building buildings itself. There's people waiting. I thought it was just game stuff and everybody's super relaxed and that's just because we're building computer games and who cares. No, this is happening everywhere. And that is incredible to realize that it is a big problem. And the reason why we have the problem is because simulations are so powerful, because the allure of it is so strong that you need simulations these days. You cannot go behind. You cannot go past it. And then we have to suffer the consequences, meaning compute. And that is an interesting balancing game.
Do you find that the simulation demands that the users, or the rendering demands that the users are putting on it, kind of expand to fit the available capacity? That if I'm doing a simulation, I'm like, well, I could use a 10-second time step instead of a 1-minute time step.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to get finished in the same time, and I've just thrown five times as much computing power at it.
For sure. I think in the past, hardware was leading and software was trailing. So you have that relationship with hardware going really, really fast. Moore's law going really, really well. Everything is going so fast. And you could literally every quarter be amazed on the new hardware coming out. This is going to speed everything up twice. Wow, this is amazing. That was the past. And I have been witnessing a reversal there, where software or a simulation site, but it's also crossing the borders to other software applications, they are leading the trend now. So there's already the sacrifice where you can have, for example, have the steps already, we're putting it, the detail that is required in the simulations is already more than what we can actually afford on the compute. But there's no choice, so we have to go for it. So it's even already past the border of waiting until we have new hardware and then we expand our horizons. No, we have already expanded our horizons, but there's no compute for it. And then there is multiple projects, and we have been working with some really interesting parties. We recently signed the NDAs with really, really big parties across the water, let's say. And there it is just very apparent. There's tens of products or projects that are just sitting there doing nothing. They're ready. The software is there. There's just no compute for it. And that is very, very interesting to see the trend. So that as we go through, it will get worse probably. That there's more and more of these problems until there's either a paradigm shift, let's say, on compute. There's something major that is completely breaks through and revolutionizes the computing industry. But that will still take 10 years at least, even if it was here today. But if that doesn't happen, which I think is very unlikely, because we have been in this computing game for a while, from a stone tablet with a hammer and try to put some numbers on it and try to compute that way, to a supercomputer now doing billions and billions of calculations. It is the same concept. We have just extrapolated further, and it's going to be very difficult to crack the code further than that, at least with our computing capacity that's in our heads. It's very difficult to sway there. So I see this problem. It's going to get worse, and we have to have more and more smart solutions. And there, the industry is fragmenting. What we used to have is you have a problem, you buy server A, and if you need more of that, you just buy more of them. And now we're seeing, well, you have an AI problem. There's 45 startups that make AI chips, and that's all the chip can do. It can only do AI. Oh, you have a communication problem. We go to this other company that just makes that. It's no longer one size fits all. It's all about the right tool for the right application. A quantum computer will do the encryption, and then we have photonics for your networking, and you have a traditional silicon for your actual computing. And that onion idea that I see coming up really, really quickly, and that's going to be a very exciting future, I think, for the data center.
So that's a very inspirational journey that you've been on, Rudy. So maybe to kind of inspire other people to follow a similar course, what would you tell a younger version of yourself?
Well, the really boring answer would be do more market validation before you start things. That's my boring answer, because some people don't want what you want. That's what I would say. And even think about it, if you would have to buy it yourself, would you do it? And then the answer back then would have been no, but I didn't think about that people would have to exchange money for this thing. When I was thinking about it, wouldn't it be cool to have this? Yes, but that doesn't mean it's going to sell. And if you have real honest with yourself and you put yourself in the frame of mind of the person that would have to buy this, and you think, would I buy that? And you would think, no, then stop, because it's probably not going to work. Or try a little bit of MVP, try to do some testing to see, can we actually sell it? So that's the boring answer. The fun answer is, just do whatever you want, because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And thinking about it too much is also not a good idea. So do, right? So no, it's not about thinking about what is the best way to do it, but it's also trying it out, talking to people, doing the market research, and not just thinking about it. But there's a bit of a conflicting answer in that sense. It's one sense is do more. The other sense is stop doing stuff, because you have to think for a bit. So it's a bit of a difficult one. But again, going is always better than doing nothing, especially in this day and age. You can do so much digitally. You can have a whole product. If the product is simple, let's say you want to build a phone stand just for your phone to charge on. You can do everything digitally. You can have a whole mock-up. You can have this website done with the mock-ups. You can have everything without a single thing to be actually manufactured. And if you really think you need it, then you go 3D print it or do something like that. If you really think you need a physical model, but most likely you don't. And if you can bootstrap it that way, that is great. If you need investors, physical investors that put money in, then I would make a prototype, 3D print one, get a CNC shop around the corner. These days, it's so easy to just go and ask, and they will say yes, and just build a mock-up and show that. But there's really so little excuses with all the advancements, partly because of the game and movie industry. There has been so much advancements in very affordable, very easy to use rendering, very easy to use website builders. It's such a blessing to build something that hasn't seen any manufacturing done, and already it feels real and feels something that you can actually get. Yeah, that's really amazing. So I would just do that, go in that route. Don't get obsessed with the hardware, because obviously I am a hardware guy. I love hardware. So when I started as a young entrepreneur, the first thing I did was build hardware. That's what we can do. This is going to be amazing. And we went straight into make the final design. And then it becomes final V4, of course. But we thought, let's just make the final design. It's going to be easy anyway. And we go for that. And then you miss a large part of the development cycle in the beginning. If you don't make prototypes and you don't do that, it's very, very risky. But yeah, I think it's very cliche, but get started. But don't get started too fast to the product.
So, Rudine, how can people reach out to you if they want to learn a little bit more?
Yeah, obviously, I recommend following us on LinkedIn. There we are always posting new stuff coming up. And then you can also add me on LinkedIn myself personally, Rudy Verwij. And then our website is a really interesting place to learn about technology. We are a relatively secretive company. We have a lot of interesting technologies. And the coming months we'll be slowly releasing some of the more details. And as a computer geek or as an enthusiast of what we're doing, it's already interesting to look at what we're doing throughout the coming months. And then on the side, if you have issues within your compute, yeah, please feel free to reach out, even if it's just a conversation. And if we find out that some product from another company works, then I will 100% recommend you to do that. So we're not here to absolutely sell our solution to your problem. But what we are here is to discuss the problem as much as possible. So I want to know as much as possible, what are the problems that you're facing? There's a flower sorting machine. Then I would like to know that, oh, actually, it turns out the flower sorting machine is actually having issues with the GPU speed because it's using a camera. And there will be a baker somewhere that turns out is using some compute that I never knew of. And then I get that data. And for us, that's super interesting. And hopefully I can also help on the other side. So we're super open to discuss any computing problem.
And then maybe just as a last inspirational question, what will you be learning next?
Me personally? Good question. I think I want to get back into my original passion of computing as a form of art. So maybe do some animations again or game design, not to do any big project with, but get back into where is the industry now. So I really departed a bit from the game art and animation industry because I went into the quote unquote serious stuff, meaning actual hardware. And now I have this amazing hardware to my disposal around the corner that I would have loved to back in the day, I would have killed for. And now it's just laying there and it's, oh yeah, those are the old systems. So I would encourage myself to learn a bit again, where is the status of the game industry? Also because it actually is very much related to what we're doing on the other side, and I can learn a thing or two about the industry.
This is a great place to stop our conversation today. I wanted to thank you for listening to Tangible Computing. While we have your attention, we really want this podcast to trigger your curiosity and motivate you to engineer a better world. So let us know if you have any ideas for future topics and speakers, or even how to make this podcast better. Just send us an email to tangible@tangiblecomputing.com.